Hi, everybody. This is The Takeaway. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess from WNYC Studios, in for Melissa Harris-Perry for a few days. Good to have you with us. We're coming out of a holiday weekend in which the Omicron variant certainly made its presence known. If you had to cancel plans because of a positive test or an exposure to COVID last week, you were not alone. Average daily cases have soared to over 214,000, surpassing a similar spike towards the end of the summer as the Delta variant spread. And we're also starting to get more of a picture of what an Omicron infection looks like. Potentially, it means less of a risk of hospitalization. But that isn't exactly good news, as Dr. Anthony Fauci warned on ABC's This Week yesterday.
If you have many, many, many more people with a less level of severity, that might kind of neutralize the positive effect of having less severity when you have so many more people. And we're particularly worried about those who are in that unvaccinated class, that, you know, tens and tens of millions of Americans who are eligible for vaccination who've not been vaccinated. Those are the most vulnerable ones when you have a virus that is extraordinarily effective in getting to people and infecting them the way Omicron is.
So, an effective virus coupled with a less than stellar vaccination rate. Here with me is Dr. Bhakti Hansoti, an associate professor of emergency medicine and international health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We just heard Dr. Fauci warn against getting complacent about Omicron, since there's data showing that it causes milder illness. So let's start there. What does the data actually show?
So the data is still out there. And the challenge here with Omicron is that the playing field is inherently different, in that there are a larger proportion of individuals who are younger that are being affected by the virus, and that a significant proportion of our patients who are COVID positive have been vaccinated and or boosted as well. So we think that this is a milder virus. This is what we saw in South Africa. But we also know that hospitalizations and, in fact, deaths are now starting to rise as the case numbers rise also.
And what are the symptoms of Omicron? How is it different from, say, Delta, for example?
So it's not significantly different from Delta. I think they're both quite similar. In fact, Omicron presents with runny nose, headache, fatigue, sneezing, and a sore throat. Your classic cold-like symptoms. And that's why many mistake it for the common cold or flu at this time of year. It is a departure from the classic three, right? The ones that we heard about in early March 2020, which were fever, cough, and loss of sensation and smell. And we really are not seeing people say, hey, you know, I can't taste anything anymore. I can't smell anything anymore, which was like the classic symptom that people anchored to early on in the pandemic.
Is it clear whether it's less severe because because people are vaccinated, or could it be that it's less severe, just less severe?
You know, I really honestly think it could be less severe because it's less severe. So as viruses mutate, there is a need for them to become less severe, because when something is less severe, it has a higher likelihood of spreading to other individuals. And so often when viruses continue to evolve and mutate, they become more infectious but less severe. And so I do think it is less severe, but it's not benign. And this was one of the challenges that we had early on in the pandemic, was when we rushed to dismiss COVID as the common cold. And we said it was just mild. It was milder than SARS and certainly milder than Ebola. Yet we've had millions dead around the world. And so I think, similar to Dr. Fauci, you know, yes, it's likely mild. You're less likely to be sick, especially if you're vaccinated, but don't take it lying down, right? This is still an illness of significant concern that is overwhelming our hospital systems.
Right. And we also heard him say he was concerned because only 62% of Americans are fully vaccinated. And as you mentioned, vaccination and also the booster shots are protecting people against this severe illness. So that number, has it budged at all? We've been hearing public officials and the medical community give these dire warnings to the unvaccinated about the risk. I'm wondering if those warnings are landing at all.
So I think they are landing, and there is a small trickle of an increase in vaccination rates. Access is really no longer an issue with a lot of great initiatives countrywide accessing those hard-to-reach populations. However, the vaccine resistance that some individuals have seems to be sticking and is there to stay despite the new variant and the impact that it's having on their lives.
There's also the capacity issue in hospitals. Early in this pandemic, we were talking about flattening the curve to not overwhelm hospital capacity. And now we're nearly 2 years into the pandemic. Where's the capacity at now, especially with Omicron?
So we are completely overwhelmed. I'm an emergency physician who worked during these holidays. Right now, about 65,000 individuals are hospitalized and 15,000 in the ICU. But the CDC forecasts that this burden will be over 100,000 by Jan 1st. And so the challenge that we're having at the hospital is fourfold. One, hospitals have always operated at capacity. You don't ever go into an ER and say, this looks pretty empty right now. On top of that, we have this triple respiratory threat. We have Delta, which was surging as well. We have Omicron, which has now taken over. And then we have seasonal influenza. And influenza A cases in particular are increasing. So early on, and on top of that, we also have the fact that many have left the workforce. Either they were laid off early during the pandemic, or there is burnout or, you know, individual situational needs, such as themselves getting COVID or their loved ones getting COVID, for which they've had to change jobs. So add to all of that, right now, that early on in the pandemic, we had this fight in us. We were, as healthcare workers, we were there all day, all night, ready to don on our PAPRs. There was surge preparedness planning, and everything was thrown at this virus. But 2 years in, I think there's fatigue. There's a lack of resources available. We don't have the manpower to do the same all hands on deck responses. And those elective surgeries that we used to cancel for short periods to create some space to care for our patients, that is no longer a feasible option.
So what was it like this weekend where you were?
So it was busy and it felt heavy. Honestly, you know, I'd got to that stage where, you know, I felt okay going to work, just wearing my surgical mask and then putting on my full PPE when there's someone that's COVID positive. But what happened recently was that everybody was COVID positive. And now I also have the knowledge that despite being vaccinated and boosted, I can very well bring this virus back to my 1-year-old and 4-year-old who are unvaccinated. And so putting on that PAPR, tying the battery pack to my waist, putting on that hood, it felt heavy and I felt really tired.
I'm sorry. I know a lot of people had to cancel their holiday plans because they tested positive or maybe they had a high enough risk from being exposed to COVID, but certainly not everyone canceled their plans. And I wonder when we might start to see evidence of a post-Christmas spike and what that might look like.
Absolutely. So we're already seeing that post-Christmas spike, but I think in the next 5 days, we'll likely see significant surges, both in the number of COVID positives, but also the number that are hospitalized.
Is there anywhere else in the world that we could be looking to see when this Omicron wave might end? I'm thinking maybe of South Africa, which is where Omicron was first identified, although not where it first originated. There's been some news in the last few days, I think, about waves of infections in that country.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can look across to South Africa, but a better comparison are our colleagues across the pond in England. So in England, we have seen that cases have doubled every 2.5 days, and that now there seem to be some evidence of a peak that's going to hopefully improve. So I would watch England. Similar with Delta, England surged first, and then the US was sure to follow. So let's keep an eye on our colleagues across the pond.
And what other patterns are you noticing in the United States? Which states or which part of the country could be potentially hit hardest?
So I think it's hard to say, right? I think right now what we're seeing is that this is extremely, extremely transmissible and spreading very fast. So I personally think that we're going to see, you know, if you look at the New York Times map, the whole country going red. We're also seeing reinfection with symptoms and hospitalization. So it's really not sparing anybody. Obviously, areas of the country that have lower vaccination rates, rural areas, areas with lower healthcare resources, that is where we're going to see the increases in death and hospitals declaring that they have no longer got capacity to manage patients and announcing a disaster declaration.
Dr. Bhakti Hansoti is Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine and International Health at Johns Hopkins University and Bloomberg School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so now a little transparency here from the Takeaway team. Sikhan Akpan is health and science editor for the WNYC newsroom, and he was on the show last week to talk about the latest on the Omicron wave. And he was booked to give us an update today as well, but then over the weekend, he tested positive for COVID. So we tried to let him rest, but we also wanted to hear how he's doing. Hi, Sikhan, how has it been?
Hey, how's it going? I'm feeling much better today.
When did you test positive?
So I tested positive on Sunday around 7 a.m. on an Abbott rapid test. It was about 3 hours before I was supposed to travel cross country from New York City to California. One thing about these tests is that, you know, some antigen brands are just a single test, while others, like the Abbott, call for taking two tests over consecutive days in order to maximize accuracy.
These are like the at-home tests, right?
Yeah, these are the at-home tests. Yeah, sorry, just to clarify. So my experience speaks to that. You know, I tested negative Saturday morning, and then, you know, on the second test in my kit, I tested positive about 24 hours later on Sunday morning. My symptoms escalated really fast. You know, I went from having no fever when I woke up to about 102 mm-hmm. to 2 degrees in about 3 hours. You know, and aside from runny nose and wet cough, those early hours felt sort of like someone was occasionally stepping on my chest, like just below my collarbone. Like the chest congestion was like pretty intense, especially whenever I coughed. I also had a lot of aches in my upper back. But, you know, despite all of that, you know, I'm very much considered a mild case.
It doesn't sound so mild. So are you feeling any better now? Same?
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better now. You know, my fever broke this morning. I'm still a little achy. I'm eating chicken noodle soup for breakfast, which is not my normal, although I do really love chicken noodle soup. You know, while my symptoms were worsening, I messaged a doctor on Twitter that I sometimes interview for COVID stories to ask them, you know, do you think people are underestimating just how bad mild cases can feel? And, you know, they said, you know, think about the worst cold you've ever had, and then about 10% of the time, a truck hits you on your way to Duane Reade to get medicine. So, you know, I think I was lucky in that, you know, I'm fully vaccinated and also boosted. But it, you know, my symptoms were really laid me out, and like I really feel for anybody who is catching this right now.
Well, Sikhan Akpan is health and science editor for the WNYC newsroom, enjoying chicken soup this morning and hopefully on the mend from COVID. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This year, I hosted a podcast series called La Brega, an anthology of stories about Puerto Rico. To be in La Brega is to be in the struggle, to find a creative way around a challenge that you can't quite solve. You can only just cope with it. And as someone who has reported on Hurricane Maria and the debt crisis, there's one word that really sticks out to me when I hear it. Resilience.
Puerto Ricans' resilience on display.
And I see the plight of the Puerto Rican people. They're very resilient.
Such resilience.
Tremendously resilient.
This language makes me want to crack a molar. The word resilient, when applied to people going through hardship, puts the focus on individuals for being strong, instead of asking why they need superhuman strength to begin with. And in the pandemic, we've seen this word resilience in headline after headline. A couple of weeks ago, just as everything was feeling very much like March 2020, I saw a how-to piece that made me clench my jaw extra hard. A guide to cultivating resilience in 2022. You can become stronger in this time of challenge, the article said. even stronger, I wondered, going into a third year? And it turns out, a lot of you are also really tired of being told how not to be so tired.
Hey, this is David from New York City. How do I feel about calls for personal resilience and grit during the pandemic? I can't help but think that those calls must be coming from people replete with tremendous good fortune and privilege. Because even before the pandemic, I was howling that Americans are just overworked to the bone. And to navigate that in the midst of a pandemic is too much for so many people to deal with. So calls for grit and personal resilience sound to me spectacularly out of touch with real people.
Hi, this is Melanie calling from Chester, South Carolina. I, as a healthcare provider, a mom, and former teacher, I feel like that these calls for continued personal resilience are, frankly, just so tired of hearing it. It's just a little overwhelming, and it's okay to be a little sad. It's okay to be a little disappointed that plans have to be changed, and continuing to talk about resilience and blowing artificial positivity, it's at this point, it's just a little too much.
Hi, I think calls for resilience and grit during the pandemic are awful, and that they most burden the people who have spent all of their resilience and grit, or whose resilience and grit is already necessary for the other things they and we struggle with. This is Belinda from Oakland, California. Thanks.
For too many of my friends, including myself at times, just trying to exist at a subsistence level is a radical act. We shouldn't have to develop more grit just to get through this.
Another person who is frustrated with the word, and has been for a while, is Liz Lenz, a journalist and author of Belabored. Liz also puts out a newsletter called Men Yell at Me, where she recently wrote about the same self-help articles that have caught my eye. I asked her, can you define personal resilience? Like, what are we talking about when we talk about resilience?
I think there is our cultural conversation of resilience, which is really kind of this capitalist bootstrappy ethic of, you know, you just gotta like live your best life and find a way to overcome the odds. But, you know, my own personal definition of resilience is a lot more complicated, because I actually don't believe that you can overcome the odds all the time, nor should you. And that definition, that cultural definition of resilience, really kind of shirks the responsibility of what we've done as a nation, of the way that we've built inequality into our system. And then we just expect people to, you know, bootstrap themselves through it when it's impossible. So, you know, my own personal definition of resilience is more like lying on the floor screaming. that's how I do it.
Well, if it's not clear to everyone already, you and I are both frustrated by this encouragement to somehow find grit and strength in this moment. But to be clear, I just want to acknowledge we're not saying getting help for a mental health crisis is ridiculous and not a fair ask. Can you help me tease out why the resilience narrative feels so wrong while actually treating things like depression and anxiety is totally reasonable?
Yes. I mean, I would like to say I do see a therapist regularly, and I recommend it if you can.
Same. Yep.
Yes. It's so wonderful. It's so good. You know, there is getting the help you need, but there is also a narrative in our nation. I mean, we're going into a third year of a pandemic. Over 800,000 people are dead. And yet, you know, there's still this emphasis on living your best life while people are dying. And while our nation is falling apart at the seams, while democracy is under attack, while reproductive rights are being rolled back, you know, voting is being restricted there. And then there's also this narrative, you know, before I took myself off of Facebook, you know, I saw on Facebook somebody post like, oh, here's, you know, here's all the things that I've been learning and all my self-growth through the pandemic. And I was like, what is the point of this? You know, people are dying, and yet somehow we have this emphasis on hashtag living our best lives. Like, why is it not okay to live our worst lives? I mean, people are dying. If we can't live our worst lives now, then when can we? My friend and the author, Kate Bowler, talks about this a lot, that, you know, we have this cultural ethic of always just overcoming when sometimes things cannot be overcome. You know, structural racism is not just something you can, you know, self-help your way out of. You know, we have a society that continues to refuse to have paid parental leave or have affordable childcare. Women are being forced out of their jobs at a rate that has not been seen since post-World War II, when we forced women out of their jobs so that the soldiers could have them back, you know, when they came home from war. Like, we are seeing our society is regressing. You can't just, you know, like, mind over matter this crap. And I don't think you should have to. But I do think it is really hard to have that conversation, you know, because we live in a society that's just so focused on not seeing, you know, the dark underbelly, of not seeing the reality. And, you know, my own personal ethic of resilience says we got to grapple with that. You know, I'm not going to go forward and live my best life while friends and family are dying and my neighbors, you know, and, you know, I live in a red state. It's been really hard to find a way to live ethically and morally and with care and compassion for everyone. And it's a struggle. And I think it should be a struggle, and we should acknowledge that struggle.
There's this way that we talk about individual resilience with, you know, infrastructure, for example. We want our bridges and our buildings to withstand climate change and natural disasters, and that totally makes sense. I know you live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a town that has seen a lot of intense flooding and destruction in the past decade. Are you thinking about resilience on that scale in any sense related to this frustrating resilience on the individual scale?
We fetishize the person who can overcome the odds and ignore all the other people who were overcome by the odds. Because if we can do that, then we can ignore the way that our system is failing people. If we focus on the self-made millionaire, we can ignore all the system-made people who are in poverty. But, like, there is no such thing as a self-made millionaire, right? Like, there's no such thing as, you know, somebody who overcame all the odds by themselves. Like, people get help. But we want to, I think, as a culture, especially an American culture, we want to focus on those stories so that we can ignore how our system is failing. And our system is crumbling. And it's hard to ignore how the system is crumbling, right? We are the wealthiest nation in the world. And we had, you know, health frontline workers who were not able to get the PPE that they needed.
There's this way that we talk about individual resilience with infrastructure. For example, we want our bridges and our buildings to withstand climate change and natural disasters. And that totally makes sense. I know you live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, a town that has seen a lot of intense flooding and destruction in the past decade. Are you thinking about resilience on that scale?
Yeah, you know, I've lived in Cedar Rapids, Iowa since 2005. And since then, I mean, you could argue it's my fault, but since I moved here, we've had two historic floods and an inland hurricane we had last year, which completely destroyed our town. And the way that the town talks about the recovery of that inland hurricane, also called a derecho, it was really frustrating, right? Because we talk about, like, oh, how we overcame it, but people were left homeless on the street for 5 days while our town was struggling to even figure out recovery. And so, you know, when we talk about we overcame it, who overcame what? Right. And so, yes, that's what I'm talking about, that in our narratives of triumph, we don't forget who we left behind, because it's not really a triumph if people were left homeless on the street for 5 days. You know, I was working for my local paper then. I put my cell phone number in an article in the paper, and I had senior citizens calling me because they were starving. Sorry, that memory just always gets me every time.
I understand.
And now the story is, yay, we overcame and we're replanting trees. And I just can't get those voices out of my head. And I just think some people are okay, but who isn't okay? You know, who got left behind? Who never made it back to their home from, you know, the Red Cross shelter, who had to live out of their cars. And I just want us to be thinking about this when we think about our resiliency, when we think about rebuilding roads or childcare tax credits, you know, who's allowed to overcome and who's allowed to have grit and who's left homeless and starving.
Yeah, right. I mean, resilience is a response to trauma, but our trauma, as you've written, is not yet over when it comes to this pandemic. Liz Lenz is a journalist and author of Belabored. She also has a newsletter called Men Yell at Me, where she recently wrote about being frustrated with personal resilience. Liz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Keith from Dallas, and I feel like grit and resilience don't play any part in keeping the pandemic from getting worse. This is not a macho thing. This is a medical thing. So time will tell. The survivors of this are going to be people who are smart and who have followed directions.
This is Rob from Boston South Shore. The idea of personal resilience or grit during the pandemic, I find it interesting that most of the people that seem to be making this call are not mental health professionals, don't work in the field. They just kind of want to be tough guys.
Hi, my name is Emily Jones, and I'm calling from West Orange, New Jersey. And I feel like calls for personal resilience and developing grit during the pandemic are insulting to how much folks have already dug in and used almost all of the grit and resilience we've had while politicians and business folks have been able to live a life using less of their grit because of the cushions they have and the privilege that they're exercising to do more of what they want and less of what the general public really, really needs during these hard times.
This is Julie Moss, and I'm calling from Fairfax in California. I think calls for resilience are useless because they don't address at all the barriers to resilience, which are fundamentally childhood trauma. Without addressing that and ways to deal with that, it's impossible to urge people to be resilient, or rather, it's useless.
Hi, this is Mindy from Los Angeles. I'm the head of operations for a company that deems essential workers. We've been working with the public since April 2020. Resilience is absolutely necessary, but I think it has to be balanced with patience and grace, as this is exhausting. And I can't even imagine what it's like for medical workers, but you know, having compassion for the people around you, especially in the workplace, I find that when one person is weak, we can lean on each other. But resilience, I guess, all in all, is a group effort. And it's exhausting.
This is Lindsay from Salt Lake. I think it's a load of horse crap. Why should we ask people who are dealing with intense grief, loss, and PTSD to be resilient and have grit? That's not what we would ask anyone to do who is struggling in a time of intense change and trauma. Let's stop asking people to be resilient. We are not doing anything normal. We can't be normal. Let's instead deal with the trauma that we are experiencing.
I'm On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry. And once you start thinking about the cult of resilience, you see its messaging all around you. How we should push through pain in all areas of our lives. It happened to me a few weeks ago. I was scrolling through Twitter when I saw a thread from my friend, WNYC's Tracy Hunt. It stopped me in my tracks. Here she is reading it.
The surgeon who took out my fibroids told me that people should tell their doctors if they experience any pain with their periods, not just severe pain. Pain-free periods should be the standard. Any pain rather than just severe pain, because from the time we first get our periods, we're told the pain is normal. And as we get older and the pain gets worse, we tell ourselves nothing's wrong. And then one day, you've got several clementine-sized fibroids clogging up your uterus.
The replies were incredulous. It had never occurred to many of us that bad cramps weren't just totally normal, that any pain at all was cause for concern. Just another example of assuming that there's a degree of suffering that can just be gotten used to or pushed past. And it turns out that this is affecting a lot of women. Of the estimated 26 million women between age 15 and 50 who have uterine fibroids, more than half of them will experience complications. And for some reason, we don't know why, Black women are more likely than white women to have fibroids, and also more likely to have painful symptoms from them. For more on this, I spoke with Dr. Anessa Vines, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health, and Patrice Peck, the senior opinion editor at Cosmopolitan. Patrice recently wrote about the toll of fibroids on Black women for the New York Times.
Fibroids are benign tumors that grow in the muscle of the uterus, and they can really range in size from that of a sesame seed to sometimes like a watermelon. And they can be dangerous because sometimes the people with fibroids experience related health problems or symptoms that can be quite severe. And those can include heavier and more painful periods, as you just mentioned, frequent urination, abdominal bloating, lower back pain, painful sex, and rarely but sometimes infertility.
And Dr. Vines, can you expand a bit more on the idea I mentioned in the introduction that painful periods are actually not normal? What's okay and what's actually cause for concern?
No, I was very intrigued by that statement because it is something that we as women do not talk about. We don't talk about, like, what is a normal period? How much of a flow should I really have? It's just, we begin menstruation. These are the products that you will need for the rest of your reproductive years. And you'll have a week where you're not feeling the greatest, but it's okay because you're not alone. All women experience this and it will be okay. But it's not okay when we don't really start talking more about what is happening in our body with regards to the amount of blood loss, pain, cramping, the length of time for that particular period. And we just need to talk more about it. It's not something that we need to communicate the message of, oh, push through it, every woman goes through it. That is not the response that we need to take, especially when you're confronted with more than 70% of all women experiencing uterine fibroids before they reach menopause, with 80% of those being Black women in their prime reproductive years. We have to change the narrative to really uncover what is normal and what is not. And for those situations where a period or pelvic pain is not normal, we need the doctors and the researchers to be responsive to those concerns.
I saw a statistic that Black women are two or three times more likely than white women to have uterine fibroids and more likely to have debilitating symptoms from them. We don't know why, but do you have any guesses?
We do not know why. There's also research that is showing that Black women develop fibroids at an earlier age that tend to be 10 to 15 years earlier than their white counterparts. And so the fibroids also tend to be larger, more symptomatic, and so forth. And so for me, in my research, I'm looking at the role of stress that, and it touches on that resilience factor that you mentioned. So in thinking about stress, specifically among Black women, I'm thinking about that lived experience, that intergenerational lived experience that has been shaped, you know, by various historical factors, cultural factors, and just our social political context in general. And there is research, you know, that talks about racism as the fundamental cause of not just uterine fibroids, but of many health disparities, if not all, because it does shape one's access to resources. It does dictate where one might live, play, work, and even dream.
And Patrice, in the course of your reporting for The Times, you talked to several Black women who suffer from symptoms. Can you talk about their experiences living with fibroids, the toll that it took on them?
I had the idea to dig into the invisible emotional toll that fibroids were having on Black women in particular, because a really good friend of mine, a Black woman named Kwesi Mgwaza, who I included in the piece, I got a call from her a couple months ago. She had informed me that she was at the hospital because she had passed out at a Starbucks. And she had told me just very matter-of-factly, trying to like rush through it. And I was like, wait a minute, what happened? Why did you pass out? And she had let me know it's because, you know, her blood levels were very low. And that is a result of the anemia that is caused by her, you know, severe uterine fibroids, because that can sometimes be a symptom. She felt as though she could just push through and kind of put her own well-being on the back burner. And so I just thought that was very interesting. And I interviewed a few other Black women of different professional backgrounds and ages, and they all spoke to me about their symptoms not being believed by medical professionals several times.
Right.
Some of them,
like, they're being gaslighted by the medical establishment.
Yeah. They felt as though they were being gaslighted, ignored, unheard. Some of them had mentioned it wasn't until they were seen by a Black doctor that they were able to finally be diagnosed with this condition that they had not even ever heard of. So it just really revealed this kind of common thread of just sitting alone and dealing with this severe condition that you're already disproportionately impacted by, but then you're also experiencing this condition in a very unique way by being a Black woman in our society.
Can both of you talk about what advice you have for women and people with periods when it comes to this particular health issue? I mean, it seems like it's not just about asking your doctor, but also about finding a doctor who's going to be attuned to this as a problem, who's going to think that pain is actually not normal, which it doesn't sound like a lot do.
So I actually spoke with Tori Dixon, a licensed professional counselor who works with Black women who experience fibroids. I spoke with her for this piece, and she gave some really good suggestions about what Black women who are trying to just push through this severe condition can do. She said, you know, it's important to dismantle those superwoman stereotypes by learning when and how to say no, you know, embracing self-compassion over perfectionism and really scheduling in time for yourself. And most importantly, like, just knowing when to ask for help and recognizing the signs that your mind, along with your body, have been impacted by fibroid diagnosis or impacted by fibroids. So that includes, you know, asking yourself, have you had your social activities changed since your diagnosis? Are you sad or depressed? Are you having trouble concentrating or sleeping? Or are you crying a lot? You know, has your appetite changed? Has your weight changed? Or are you even having suicidal thoughts? Those might all be indications that, you know, it might be time to talk to a mental health professional, as many of the women who I interviewed have done. But overall, I would say you know, just to remember that this is not all doom and gloom. As Dr. Vines and myself have said, this is an opportunity to empower yourself by joining in community with other people who are also impacted by the same condition you are, and to really just educate yourselves and become more informed and to just, you know, raise awareness.
I would just add that, one, I'm very appreciative of the article that Patrice wrote. I hope that it will continue to stimulate dialogue about fibroids, because the more we can talk about fibroids, we make it visible. And when we make it visible, it makes it easier for women to share with their loved ones, their partners, their employers, what is going on. And so it makes this much more of a real, tangible problem that we can address. Also, for women, ask questions of your doctor, you know, challenge them. Let's check for fibroids. There are so many treatments that are now underway. Explore them all via Google. And for those who do not have access to healthcare, that's even more reason for those who have access to healthcare to talk about fibroids, the options, what's normal, what's not normal for those women who don't have access, so that they can be able to find sources for care and support.
Thank you so much. Patrice Peck is the senior opinion editor at Cosmopolitan, and Dr. Anessa Vines is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the UNC Chapel Hill Gilling School of Global Public Health. Thank you both for joining us.
You're welcome,
you.
Alana.
Hi, this is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. I had a massive fibroid that was the size of a small South American country, and thousands of little ones on top of that. And following my fifth child, I was told that it was even bigger, and we talked about it, and the doctor said that I could take birth control to shrink it, which I can't do because I have reactions. And then I asked if we could surgically remove them, and he said no, that I would bleed to death. And the only other option was for me to have a hysterectomy, which my doctor did not want me to have because I was only so young, 33. But I told him that if I promised to have that uterus bronzed and put on the baby shelf with all of the 5 pairs of baby shoes, after having so many children, that would he please, please take it out? And my husband begged too, because, you know, we had 3 young children that were all in different sized Pampers at the time. So yeah, fibroids are no fun. They make you bleed a lot and cramp and look pregnant all the time, and you become anemic.
Hi, Alexandra Phillips, Boulder, Colorado. Fibroids, uterine fibroids. Yes, I spent 10 years of my life with them. Misdiagnosed, even though I had got them at 40, which is the most common predictor of having uterine fibroids. I was misdiagnosed for 2 years and pretty much dismissed by any doctors, saying that it was perimenopause and just go home and deal with it. Yeah, it was awful. And it's a very common thing in women. It's amazing how many women are misdiagnosed, and hope you can spread the word about it.
This is Benita Shore from Madison, New Jersey. Yes, I had fibroids in the past. By the time it was removed, it was basically the size of a grapefruit, and had caused a great deal of trouble.
Hi, this is Leda, and I'm calling from Southern California, and I have lived with fibroids in the past. They created a lot of problems, a lot of issues, and it ended up by me having a partial hysterectomy in October of 2012.
This is Michelle from Dallas. I did have fibroids in the past, and they made for very heavy, messy monthly cycles. I was very shocked that in the course of 1 year, I went from having little pea-sized fibroids to one that was so big that my OB called it my uterine annex. And in grams, when it was all removed because it led to a hysterectomy, it was almost the same size as the uterus. Good thing to get these things checked out.
My name is Alana Casanova-Burgess, filling in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Looming on so many people's minds these last few months has been the future of abortion care in America, which may soon become more restrictive depending on upcoming decisions by the Supreme Court. Cases like Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which is challenging Mississippi's new law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy, are more far-reaching than meets the eye. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of the Mississippi law, it could further erode reproductive rights across the country. So, what effect will that have on women who seek that care? It's a question that has been hard to answer scientifically. Researchers can't just randomly assign outcomes to women in order to study what happens to them. But a new study has found a way around that problem. The Turnaway Study, led by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, found that pregnant women who were denied an abortion fared far worse in several aspects of their life. That includes educationally, financially, physically, and mentally. Here to talk with us on the long-term effects women face when denied an abortion is science and health journalist Mariana Lignaro. Mariana, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
What are the major findings of this study?
The study compared women who received an abortion and women who were denied an abortion because they were too far along in their pregnancies. So those are very similar groups, with the exception of one receiving the abortion and the other being denied an abortion. So in terms of the socioeconomic consequences of being denied an abortion, the study found that women who were denied an abortion were much more likely to live in poverty than the ones who received an abortion. So 61% of women denied an abortion lived below U.S. federal poverty levels in comparison to 45% of the ones who received the abortion. They were also more likely to be unemployed, more likely to be receiving financial benefits from the temporary assistance for needy families, and they were more likely to report not having enough money for living expenses. The study also compared the credit scores of these two groups of women, and they looked back a few years into their credit scores, and they learned that their financial circumstances were trending very similarly up until the point where they seek abortion. In that moment, women who were denied an abortion, they suffer an increase of debt and in the number of negative public records, like bankruptcy or eviction.
Can you explain more about how the research was conducted? What made the study so comprehensive compared to previous research?
Yes, so this is a very big study. So they recruited almost 1,000 women in 30 abortion facilities over 21 states in the United States. As you mentioned before, it's very hard to measure the impact of abortion because you can't randomly assign an abortion or deny an abortion to have a perfect experiment. So what this study did, which was very clever, according to the researchers that I interviewed, is that they found a natural experiment. Many women are already being denied an abortion because they are too far along in their pregnancies when they go to these facilities. So what the author of this study designed was that they compared these women who were seeking an abortion and were too late in their pregnancies with women who were late in their pregnancies, but they were just under the gestational limit and they received the abortion. So according to many of the scientists that I interviewed, this was a very clever way to compare two groups of women who had very similar backgrounds. So the only difference between them was that one received the abortion and the other didn't receive the abortion. And they followed these women for 5 years, interviewing them every 6 months. And they asked all kinds of questions about their financial situation, education, mental health, physical health, relationships. So it's very comprehensive.
You mentioned the credit score difference and other financial effects. What about issues stemming from physical health? What did the researchers find?
More women who gave birth because they were denied an abortion report fair or poor physical health. So 27% of them report fair or poor physical health, compared to 20% of the women who did receive the abortion. And they found two deaths in women who were denied an abortion from causes related to pregnancy or childbirth. And in the group of women who received the abortion, there weren't any cases of deaths.
What about mental health?
Abortion did not increase mental health problems like anxiety or depression, but they did find short-term decline in mental health among women who were denied an abortion. So many studies before had found an association between abortion and mental health problems, but that probably comes from the fact that women seeking an abortion already have existing mental health problems, which may be part of why they are seeking abortion. So it's an association, but it's not a causal association. In this study, they didn't find any emerging cases of depression or anxiety due to having an abortion.
Mm. And right now, we're at a crossroads in the U.S. as abortion laws in some states are looking to become way more restrictive. What does the study suggest about what that would mean for women across the country?
The study is looking into a very specific group of women. So 90% of women who seek abortion in the United States are early in their pregnancies, in their first trimester. This study is looking into women who are further along in their pregnancies. So it's a specific group. But according to researchers that I interviewed, these findings of the study could suggest what may happen in the United States if abortion laws become stricter. So it suggests that people who are denied an abortion may suffer from these social economic problems, physical health and mental health problems that the study found if they are unable to get an abortion or to travel to a place where abortion is legal for their cases.
That was Science and Health reporter Mariana Lignaro. She recently wrote about the Turnaway study for Scientific American. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's our show today. But we'd be remiss to not mention that yesterday the world lost a giant when Desmond Tutu, a champion of peace, died in Cape Town at the age of 90.
Let the waters of healing flow from Pretoria today to cleanse our land, to cleanse its people, and to bring unity and reconciliation. And holding hands together, black and white, we will stride together into the future.
At 5'4", his voice was among some of the biggest in calling for the end of apartheid in South Africa in his capacity as Archbishop. His work earned him the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 and the love and adoration of the world. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Alana Casanova-Burgess, in for Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.